gallant American women. This is the story of women who have helped to develop the American way of life.
Soldiers of destiny, mothers of might, co-makers of history. Women whose names are written large upon the honor rolls of our nation's great. Women courageous who have served and sacrificed, worked and dreamed, pioneered and persevered. Women whose names, deeds, and claims to fame have often been forgotten.
This is their story, and it is your story. 3 centuries of women whose deeds are rooted deep in our past and whose influence will reach far into the future. It is the story of you, the pioneer women of today, who are blazing the trails of tomorrow. The United States Office of Education and the National Broadcasting Company take pride in presenting the 7th chapter in this epic tale of women in the making of America. We bring you today the story of the development of laws as they affected American women and their place in American life. We present Laws and the Woman.
Time, 1939. Place, a house in Phoenix, Arizona. A woman bends over the stove, cooking. When a man opens the front door.
Evening, honey. Dinner ready?
Just about.
Great. Must have dashed right home from work.
Why, Mary, what's the matter, honey?
Oh, nothing.
Yes, there is. I can see it in your face.
Well, let's wait till after dinner, John.
No, tell me now. If there's anything wrong, I want to know it right now.
It looks as if I'm going to lose my job.
You? Lose your job? But you're joking. What did the government of Arizona do without you?
Well, apparently you don't read the papers. A bill has been introduced into the legislature which, if passed, will prohibit married women from working. The bill says that a husband and wife cannot both be on the payrolls.
Oh, that's ridiculous, Mary, in this day and age. Besides, there are lots of jobs that only women can hold.
Well, nevertheless, that's what the bill proposes to do. And there are 26 other states thinking of doing the same thing. If a husband and wife each earn over $100 a month...
Well, who are they to tell us how much we can earn?
They, dear, are the people in a democracy. They probably think it'll put men back to work, increase buying power.
Well, it certainly won't increase ours. Oh, just when we were beginning to make ends meet. Oh, I'm afraid if the bill is passed, we'll have to give up this house. I can never meet the payments alone.
Well, I suppose I can get another job.
Just like that, eh? With a campaign on against married women working? Oh, it isn't fair. It doesn't make any sense in a country dedicated to freedom.
In America, this prejudice against married women working. The Indian women shared with their men the duties and privileges of providing for the family. And in the more civilized tribes, they shared other privileges as well. Even today, it's told the tale of the women of the Iroquois Indian tribe.
The time, about 1500. Warriors are gathered about the council fire in the longhouse of the Iroquois. Outside the door, a band of women, listening.
You hear? The men talk of war. Now is our time. We must go in.
Not I. I fear their anger.
We all have sworn our oath to do this thing. Come, mothers of braves and wives of braves.
What means this? Squaws entering the longhouse? While the men are met in council?
We come to join you.
No squaws shall sit with us to talk of plans for war.
Then we shall bear no sons to fight your wars. Is this a tribe of men alone?
Silence! You chatter like the squirrel. And yet you know that women shall have no voice.
Deny us if you will. But we, your squaws, will give no sons. for counsels barred to us. All these shall be our powers, these our rights, and more.
You ask more?
In choosing your chiefs, we ask a voice, and at your council's equal place. The land we live upon, we ask to hold with you, our name with yours.
On colonial deeds of Indian land, the squaw's mark appeared beside that of her grave. But the white men who bought that land brought new laws with them, laws less inclined to share property and privileges with the women folk. And when they had no law, they made one of their own. In Salem, a woman who dared to express opinions contrary to those of the elder had a cleft stick clamped on her tongue. And in the colony of Virginia...
Hey, hey.
What it is?
Hey, hey. Hey, Betsy, wife of John Tucker, has not only broken that peace and law which ought to have been betwixt them by laying hands upon her husband to the danger of his life, but has also broken ye king's peace. It is therefore ordered that she be tied to the ducking stool and publicly ducked in the river till she repent.
Betsy Tucker, to be ducked, that's no way to treat a woman.
Serves her right, say I. Were this law in all lands, it would cure the noise in many women's heads. Hey, hey! Hey, hey! Where's Betsy, wife of John Tucker?
New land, new laws. And as America grew, her laws grew more liberal. Stocks and docking stools disappeared. Women sharing responsibility for taming this wilderness were helping to work out a better scheme of life. New country and a spirit of independence. In America, as in England, women were managing property, deeding land, running ferry boats, operating business.
But even as they expressed their vitality and initiative, something was happening in far-off England that menaced their independence. In a musty book-lined room in London, a sullen-faced gentleman bent over a heap of foolscap, writing, while another man thumbed through the papers.
I say, Blackstone, this is really a monumental work you're turning out. It looks as if you're laying down the law once and for all.
My dear Faversham, it is merely my commentary on the laws of England.
Well, you seem to have commented mightily on the common law. But what of equity, as dispensed by the King's Chancellor?
The Chancellor, keeper of the King's conscience. What does he know about law?
He knows enough to temper it with justice. Why, life would be pretty harsh, Blackstone, without equity. Just suppose the people of England and the colonies should take your word as law and forget about the customs we've built up. Then where would they be?
Why, in England and the colonies.
Oh, you know what I mean. What would happen to the poor who can't pay their debts? And what would happen to the women?
The women, Faversham, are the favorites of the law in England.
If I know anything about women, they'd rather be free than favorites. All this rot you've written here, that upon marriage, a woman's property must all be surrendered to her husband.
And so it must, by the law of God, as well as by the law of England.
Why, confound it, man. I know dozens of wives that own their own property. Yes, and have a say-so in managing of their families, too. You couldn't tell them that a man may will away his unborn children and dictate to his wife. Why, what do you know about women, anyway?
I have a holy reverence for women. Me, they're frail, angelic creatures that must be protected.
That proves you don't know anything about them. You know what I think, Blackstone? I think you're really a woman hater. In marriage, the husband and wife should become one.
My dear Faversham, the husband and wife do become one. And that one is the husband.
Dictating custom. Even in America, which had inherited the fairer rules of equity, even there, Blackstone's word became law. And in 1776, the men of the colonies declared independence from laws in which they had no voice.
The history of the present King of Great Britain is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations, all having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over these states.
And even as the men sat in Independence Hall forming the laws of the new nation, Abigail Adams sent a warning to her husband, John Adams.
In the new code of laws, I desire you to remember the ladies and be more generous to them than your ancestors were. Do not put such unlimited power in the hands of husbands. And remember, all men would be tyrants if they could. If attention is not paid to us, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation.
But the men were too busy to listen, busy founding the economy and industry of the young United States. So into the factories went the women and children, turning the wheels of industry, weaving the cloth, building the wealth of the nation. And into their husbands' and fathers' pockets went their wages.
But by 1825, the rebellion prophesied by Abigail Adams was already brewing. In the New York law office of the aristocratic Daniel Cady, a poorly dressed woman was pleading her case, while in a corner, Cady's young daughter, Elizabeth, sat listening.
Please, Mr. Cady, there must be something you can do. It ain't fair that after I work at the looms, till my fingers are bleeding, my man should take the money and spend it on drink. It ain't fair that my children should go ragged and hungry.
We're not discussing what is fair, Mrs. Arthur. We're discussing the law. Here, I shall read you what Blackstone said about earning. here's the place. Here's what Blackstone says. The husband is entitled to the earnings of his wife, whether made by her labor in the home or elsewhere, whether by work for him or for another.
But how am I and my children going to live?
Father, if the law hurts people, isn't it a bad law?
You mustn't interrupt, Elizabeth.
But isn't it, Father?
Oh, you see, Mrs. Arthur, there's really nothing I can do for you. I'm very sorry.
Well, if you can, sir, I guess there ain't nobody who can. Thank you. Good day.
Good day.
But it don't seem fair.
Let's see. Here's the part that Father read. The husband is entitled to the earnings of his wife. That's
women,
it.
Women. I know they take their troubles with. Why, Elizabeth, what are you doing with those scissors?
I'm cutting out the law, Father. The bad one. The one that won't let Mrs. Arthur have the money she earns.
My dear, you can't cut out laws with scissors, even though they are very sharp scissors.
Then how can I?
My dear, I'm afraid you can't.
But I must cut them out. Some way. Just you wait till I grow up. I will cut them out.
Years later, 1848. To a church in Seneca Falls, New York, Elizabeth Cady Stanton and a few friends have summoned the first women's rights convention. The child, now grown up and married, has a much more effective weapon than a pair of scissors. She is about to throw a bombshell in the middle of a long-established American custom. Slowly, she rises to face her audience.
Mrs. Lucretia Mott and I have called this convention as the founders of this nation call theirs, to announce to the world a list of grievances. Our Declaration of Independence is fashioned after theirs, though we call ours a Declaration of Sentiment. I shall read it aloud. The history of mankind is a history of repeated injuries and usurpations on the part of man toward woman, having in direct object the establishment of an absolute tyranny over her.
Listen to her.
The boldness of
to prove this, let facts be submitted to a candid world. He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she has had no voice. He has made her, if married, in the eye of the law, civilly dead.
Here.
He closes against her all the avenues to wealth and distinction.
I object. Stop that woman.
He has usurped the prerogative of Jehovah himself, claiming it as his right to assign her a sphere of action when that belongs to her conscience and her God. It is known that the women of this country ought to be enlightened in regard to the laws under which they live.
Jezebel!
That they no longer publish their degradation by declaring themselves satisfied with their present condition, nor their ignorance by asserting that they have all the rights they want.
Rebellion flamed into revolution as women rose against injustice. Gallant American women, Elizabeth Stanton, Lucretia Mott, Susan Anthony, Lucy Stone, women stumping the country, pleading with legislatures, mocked, scorned, derided, crusading for human liberty.
1853. Lucy Stone is addressing an audience in Boston. To the rear of the hall, his eyes glued on the speaker, sits a handsome young abolitionist named Henry Blackwell.
Let us protest the iniquity of our system of laws, which bind a woman to her husband in virtual slavery. Let us cry out against rules and customs which are unworthy of the name, since they violate justice. And what is justice but the essence of all law? I could never marry into slavery.
Listen to that woman, will you?
That's
a tiny, feminine creature, yet such strong conviction.
Sure, Blackwell, my wife could scold like that with only me for an audience.
She's not scolding. Well, there's the spirit of a crusader, if I ever saw it.
I tell you, she's wonderful.
Well, Blackwell, why don't you try to meet her? Meet her? I'm going to try to make her my wife. Please, Miss Stone.
What infinite blessings it will bring to the human race.
Please, Miss Stone.
What an impetus to civilization.
Please, Miss Lucy. Please, Lucy. I wish you'd take time off from your speaking to marry me.
It's sweet of you to keep asking me, Henry Blackwell, but it's no use. I'm going to devote my life to making other women's lives easier.
Then I'll help you. We'd make a wonderful team.
You are sweet.
Please say yes.
Well, Henry, I have a lot of strange ideas about marriage. For instance, I don't believe that a man should be master of his wife.
Neither do I. Give me a free woman and she can never be made a slave.
And I don't like the word obey in the marriage service.
Then we'll leave it out.
And then, well, there's the matter of children. The law says that the father has exclusive control and guardianship.
Lucy, we'll share ours.
Oh, it's hard to say no to you, Henry Blackwell. But here's one point you won't agree to. I believe that a woman should be allowed to keep her own name after marriage.
Well, all right. You may keep it.
What? But what will all the other men think?
They can think whatever they like. Now, have you any more objections to marrying me?
Why, no, Henry. I guess I haven't.
Then, would you object to kissing your fiancée, Mrs. Lucy Stone?
On the day of their wedding, May 1st, 1855, Henry Blackwell and his bride made a public protest.
We declare that this act of ours, assuming the relationship of husband and wife, implies no sanction of the present unjust laws of marriage. We believe that personal independence and human rights can never be forfeited except for crime, that marriage should be an equal and permanent partnership.
Gallant American men and women, establishing new customs, defying old laws, facing censure and ridicule.
¶¶ A dismal, stormy night in 1860. Beside an old stone hearth in Philadelphia sit Lucretia Mott and Susan B. Anthony talking when a knock sounds at the door.
I'll go, Susan.
You and your daughter take off those wet things.
Forgive me for coming here at this time of night, but I was desperate.
Why, what's the trouble, Mrs. Corey?
It's my husband, Miss Anthony. He's trying to take Amy away from me.
Please don't let him take me. He beat me.
Oh, you poor child. And the worst of it is the law's on your father's side. If he finds you here...
He shan't find them here. I'll find them a safe hiding place. Come, Mrs. Corey, quick. We must make a disguise for you both before you go out into the storm. Lucretia... Have you any old ragged children's clothes that Amy can wear? And a washerwoman's outfit?
Susan, do you realize what you're doing? If the police should find out...
Let them find out. Let them do what they will. I shall never reveal the hiding place.
Susan B. Anthony is harboring fugitives.
She's breaking the law.
She should be in prison.
Just like them women writers. They're all a bunch of lawbreakers.
Miss Anthony... You'll injure the whole cause of woman's rights. Don't you know that the law gives the father the entire guardianship and control of children?
Yes, Mr. Garrison, I do know it. And doesn't the law give the slaveholder the ownership of the slave? And don't you break the law every time you help a slave to Canada? Well, this law is just as wicked, and I'll break it just as quickly. You die before you deliver a slave to his master. And I will die before I'll give the father the ownership of that child.
Gallant American women, cutting out the unjust laws, not with the rusty scissors, but with a bright new courage, making new ones. And finally, in 1908, at the 60th anniversary of the first Women's Rights Convention, a woman was proudly able to say,
"Most of the laws which held women in subjection have been amended or repealed. The work of those early pioneers has been vindicated. It remains for us, the pioneers of today, to get out our shears and pruning hooks and finish the job."
Gallant American women, cutting out the outmoded laws, establishing new ones.
The National Woman's Party, reforming discriminatory laws throughout the states and working for a sweeping federal law.
The League of Women Voters, studying government, learning how to use their vote to get better government.
The General Federation of Women's Clubs, drafting new bills, helping to discard old ones. The National Federation of Business and Professional Women's Clubs, making a nationwide survey of laws discriminating against employment of married women.
And all together forming a joint congressional committee to work in Washington for laws of interest to the entire nation.
By 1933, the task of cutting and remaking seemed to be nearly complete. Under the Cable Act, women were even able to choose their own citizenship, irrespective of their husband's nation. Women were at last coming into their own. Business crashing, banks crumbling, human beings suffering from poverty and unemployment.
Take the jobs away from married women.
Why?
More jobs for men.
But why?
More money for non-working wives.
Why?
Why? To keep the homes together.
What homes?
Yeah, what homes? You ought to ask. Why, half of you women don't know what a home is anymore, after being in the man's world of industry and business. How'd you ever get there anyhow? How'd you ever get out of the home?
Today, the Women's Bureau of the United States Department of Labor, at the request of the League of Nations, is doing something Elizabeth Cady Stanton suggested 90 years ago, making a study of all existing laws concerning women, and they're unearthing some rather interesting facts.
Nowhere else in the world today do women have the freedom and the rights we enjoy here in America. Yet much pruning still remains to be done. Do you know that in some states of the Union, a married woman has less right to sign a contract than other adults have?
That in some states a father may will away from his wife the custody of her children.
That in one state a man may still take his wife's earnings.
Much remains to be done. And how are we to do it?
I think we should keep on working in our various states to lop off unfair laws.
I think we should pass a federal amendment to the Constitution, establishing equal rights for men and women.
I think that in time, custom will lop off these laws. As when, in 1824, a woman of Philadelphia was sentenced to be ducked for scolding. The punishment was never given, because it was deemed obsolete and contrary to the spirit of the time.
One woman who has been at the job for the past 60 years says,
"Where there are barriers, break them. Where there is opposition, besiege it. We of the past drudged and labored that you might enjoy liberties we never had."
Yesterday, gallant American women worked in various ways to bequeath you many of the rights and freedoms you enjoy today. And now, you in turn are planning and working to pass on to the women of tomorrow ways and means whereby they too can participate more effectively in American life.
Week by week, the thrilling story of gallant American women unfolds before you. Not only is the story dramatized on the air, but it is also preserved for you in permanent form. Through the cooperation of the Columbia University Press, scripts are now available. They include These Freedoms, Women in Peace, Women on the Land, Women the Providers, Refugee Women, Women Our People, and today's broadcast on Laws and Women. To help cover the cost of printing, mailing, and handling, a charge of 10 cents is made for each script. A complete list of programs is attached. Also lists of books to help you become better acquainted with the lives and deeds of these women. To get your copy, send 10 cents to Gallant American Women, Washington, D.C. The address again is simply Gallant American Women, Washington, D.C. Next week's program tells the story of women in the law. And the week following, seafaring women. Tune in next week, same time, same station, to Gallant American Women. Gallant American Women, an NBC public service feature, is a series of dramatizations prepared and presented by the United States Office of Education, Federal Security Agency, with the cooperation of the Women's Division of NBC and with the assistance of the Works Project Administration. Script by Jane Ashman, assisted by Helene Bamberger. Program supervised by Eva Hansel. Historical consultant, Mrs. Mary R. Beard of the World Center for Women's Archives. Original music by Rudolph Schrantz. This was a program of the National Broadcasting Company, RCA Building, Radio City, New York.